In the last hour, we talked about some of the nuts and bolts of evangelism, some of the structural components, if you will, of how to set up operations and launch the effort as a whole, and particularly in looking at it as a team effort rather than as an individual enterprise. But I want to shift gears to a little bit this morning and tonight, and talk a little bit about content issues. One of my mentors, Harold Comer, when it comes to matters of church growth, he once said that success in evangelism is not content specific. And I would only add, just as long as we're preaching the gospel. The truth of God, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. It's not curriculum specific. And so our job is to get the truth of God into people's hearts and let the message do the work that God designed it to do, to transform people's thinking, change their thought process, to change their lives. And so when we advertise various kinds of venues, Bible studies and so on, I sometimes advertise those as life-changing classes, life-changing truth. Because I truly believe with everything in me that God's Word changes us. But from our point of view, if we're going to be successful at this, we have to understand something of the process of how the truth of God changes people. I'm going to address the issue tonight of how to build faith in lost souls. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of Christ, Romans 10:17. And no matter where you start, you've got to understand something about conviction of mind, trust of heart, surrender of the will, something about how faith is planted in the human heart. And so I'll address that issue a little bit tonight without looking at specific places to go necessarily. I prefer to spend a lot of time in the Gospel of Luke. I like Acts of the Apostles. I love Romans chapter 6 in that regard, closing the deal, so to speak. But there are a lot of places you can go in the Gospel, as long as you're doing the same thing. And so we'll talk about that tonight. This morning, I would like to share with you a tool that I've used, God-given tool, of the book of Ecclesiastes. I like to use it on the front end. Part of winning people to Christ is going fishing for men, and I like to use the very best bait that I can put on my hook on the front end, and Ecclesiastes, for me, has been that bait. Part of handling accurately the word of truth, 2 Timothy 2:15, is knowing how to use the sword of the Spirit to penetrate what Hebrews 4:12 refers to as the deep recesses where soul and spirit are divided, joints and marrow meet, and the thoughts and intentions of the heart are discerned. And the way I look at the 66 books of the Bible, 39 in the Old Testament, 27 in the New Testament, are 66 pieces of a giant jigsaw puzzle. And each piece fills in part of the larger picture. If you didn't have 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, you would be lacking a whole lot of information in how evangelists are to do their jobs. If you didn't have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you would be lacking major information about the life of our Savior, Jesus Christ. If you didn't have the book of Genesis, you might wonder where salvation history began, where creation began, where did we come from? If you didn't have the book of Job, you might be lacking in vital information on how to deal with life's tragedies and how we have to work through suffering and adversity. Ecclesiastes is the part of the picture that focuses on our purpose in life, why we're here. And it has occurred to me that there are all kinds of people in this world, and particularly this culture, that need this information. As I go out and do the work of evangelism, it has occurred to me that a lot of people just don't have the foggiest clue about the Bible anymore. I started preaching, as I suggested earlier, 33 years ago, preached full-time, beginning 33 years ago. And even at that point, American life was so different than it is now. I have witnessed in my lifetime massive changes in the culture. And it used to be that you could almost assume a shared heritage of respect for the Judeo-Christian ethic and Scripture as revealed in the Bible in particular. I used to use the Jewel Miller, Tex Stevens film strip series and taught a lot of people the gospel using that method. And it occurred to me early on, when I got to lesson 5 and was ready to baptize this fellow and figured out that he didn't believe in God yet, that I've got to back up in the process and establish some foundational principles before I automatically assume I'm at XYZ in the process when I'm still on A, B, and C. And so early on in my work as an evangelist, I started using the book of Ecclesiastes to start forming the ABCs of the whole process, and step by step move people along in building their faith so that they would be able to make a decision for Jesus Christ and obey the gospel. But Ecclesiastes is one of those books. Philip Yancey has, before I get there, forgot about this particular slide here. I preach in the Santa Clara Valley, and we have people in the congregation up there that work at places like Apple and Google. And Google philosophy has 10 core principles, and principle number 2 is it's best to do one thing really, really well. And too often in our attempt to spur one another to love and good deeds in the work of evangelism, we have tried to do 10 or 15 or 20 things not really well at all, rather than one thing really, really well. And so I've tried to teach people to teach this particular lesson that I'm going to teach you on the front end of the evangelistic process, whether it's a home study venue, one-on-one, in a small group class, in a congregational venue like this. I've taught it to hundreds of non-Christians and thousands upon thousands of people, if you include congregations across the land. And I've almost never failed to whet someone's appetite for more if they don't know anything about the Bible. And even if they do, I've almost always been able to lure them in to look at the gospel more closely as a consequence of this particular lesson. And so I want you to listen and to take mental notes, if not physical notes, with the idea of either supporting another teacher who would teach the same lesson, or maybe teaching it yourself, maybe talking to a friend, a coworker, school classmate, whatever, and pulling out Ecclesiastes, even on the spur of the moment, because the lesson I'm about to teach is a rather easy one to learn. It involves basically just getting into the text of chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 12, making a few points, and then letting those points sink in. But there are a lot of people that, again, don't know the Bible, and Philip Yancey says not many sermons get preached on Ecclesiastes, for it is one of the Bible's most confusing books. Many conservative Christians treat it with polite distaste as if it had sneaked into the canon when no one was looking. I have a much higher view of Ecclesiastes than that. I'm sure most of you do as well. But before we get into the lesson, let me say that, just typical of our society, remarkable thing happened a few years ago in Fremont, California, when a 17-year-old girl, Karen Ching, achieved a perfect score on her on both sections of the SAT test and a perfect 8,000 on the TUF University of California Acceptance Index. Never in history up till that point had anyone achieved a perfect score on both of those tests in the same year. Brilliant, one-of-a-kind young lady, straight-A student at Mission San Jose High School in Fremont. And so the world was blessed with this brilliant, one-of-a-kind young lady who was probably well on her way to a successful law career by now. But the national news story picked up another little brief footnote, an exchange with a reporter, when the reporter asked Karen Ching, "What is the meaning of life?" This brilliant young lady replied, "I have no idea. I would like to know myself." And I want to tell you, there are a lot of people just like her in the world today. They get up every morning, they go to work, they put a long day in at work, and they go home at night, put their head on the pillow, and they have no clue. They do the same thing the day after that, so on. And so I'm going to teach you a little three-part outline that you can use, and it will force people to think. And I've taught this to staunch Southern Baptists in Alabama. I have taught it to atheists and agnostics. I've taught it to virtually every conceivable person, every kind of background you can imagine, and I have almost never failed to generate interest for more study after teaching this lesson. But before I get to the lesson proper, I'm going to, just for your eyes only, cover a couple of background points so that you can better appreciate Ecclesiastes before you try to just run off and teach it to somebody else. A couple of things I think we need to understand, even though I don't cover all these points with non-Christians. And the first point is how is the book's message communicated? You know, just as a medicine needs to have an entry system into the body in order to do good to that body, whether it's a shot or an IV or a pill somebody takes, just as a rocket needs a launching system to get off the ground, God's Word has multiple communication systems, if you will. Sometimes God communicates His message through law, sometimes through history, sometimes through prophecies, through poetry, through apocalyptic literature, through gospels, through epistles, and so on. There are a lot of different launching systems whereby God, you know, launches His message to get into people's hearts. And so I think it's important to be aware of not only what is said, but how it is said. And with regard to Ecclesiastes, Leland Ryken calls it protest literature, which is kind of interesting. We normally classify it as part of the wisdom and poetry section of the Old Testament, wisdom literature. Philip Yancey calls Solomon the first existentialist. And I taught this one time in Sunnyvale, California, and a former Hindu said, you know, this reminds me a lot of the Bhagavad Gita, the so-called holy book of the Hindu faith, because you've got all these cycles of life, and in the Gita, he said, and there's one notable difference. In the Gita, the cycles continue on and they never end, but you finally got resolution in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. I thought that was quite an observation on his part, and very insightful. The answer to why we exist in Ecclesiastes is found more through first-hand experience than through a burst of special revelation. We're privileged to go on a grand search through the eyes of one who had the wherewithal that eludes most of us. And so with that in mind, I think that Ecclesiastes is the most inductively reasoned book in the Bible. It comes through first-hand observation. Revelation plays a part. This is the end of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. Chapter 12. But getting there, getting to chapter 12, it's not as if God says, okay, this is the purpose of life, boom, this is it. No, it's kind of like a search. It's kind of like figuring out a puzzle. Is the answer behind door number one? Well, no. How about door number two? No. Door number three? No. Door number four? No. Well, what is the answer? And so the answer that Solomon comes up with in chapter 12 is the only thing left that hasn't evaporated with the wind after everything else is sought out. So it's a process of elimination. And until you get to chapter 12 and get to the conclusion of the matter, you're still held in kind of suspended animation, which is why the book reads like it does, so that you have a whole vacillation effect in which you have a negative preparation for the gospel of Jesus Christ, and as a consequence of that, we're kind of thrown for a whirlwind, back and forth, back and forth. And I think the key is an invitation to experience the process. You know, so much of life is a journey, not a destination. You know, you've heard that. And that's how Ecclesiastes reads. There are 15 negative sections, 13 positive ones. You read the end of chapter 2, and life is really good. And then the next paragraph, life is really bad. And then life is really good. And then life is really bad. Either the author is schizophrenic, or he's inviting us to a process of discovery so that we can see through his eyes what he is discovering along the way. And what he's discovering along the way is that all the historic pursuits of mankind are nothing but dead-end streets, so that the gospel of Jesus Christ is ultimately what this book is going to point toward. But along the way, this is a negative preparation for the gospel, because it shows that all the historic pursuits of mankind are dead ends. None of them produce anything of lasting worth and value when it comes to telling us why we're here and how to ultimately enjoy why we're here and to plug into our ultimate purpose. So we've got all this big maze with all these dead ends, and the tension throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, until we reach that conclusion in chapter 12, it's hinted at throughout, the conclusion is, but it's the conclusion that he comes to at the end of chapter 12 is the only thing that hasn't evaporated by the time you get to the very end. It's the only thing that makes any sense. It's the only thing left. This has got to be the conclusion, because nothing else makes any sense whatsoever. Does that make sense? I hope so. Chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 12. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. The words of the preacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see this, it is new? It has already been in the ages before us. There is therefore no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Now you're going to read this and you're going to say, what in the world is he talking about? This is a poetic book. It's a poetic delivery system, if you will. But in the midst of the poetry is a very, very powerful point that is so, so needed in our society. Now Francis Crick, who together with James Watson discovered the structure of DNA in 1953. The same Francis Crick wrote a book in 1994, toward the end of his life. He called it The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. In that book, he argues, and I quote, "You, your joys and your sorrows, your sense of personal identity and free will, are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules." That's all you are. A bunch of physical processes. Now we know intuitively that there has got to be more to a human being than that. We know intuitively. Everybody knows that. And we could talk about Romans 1. You know that. Your neighbor knows that. The staunchest atheist deep down knows it. But Ecclesiastes forces the issue. And it forces the issue in some interesting ways. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, it's all vanity. That word comes from a Hebrew word that can be translated vapor. Vapor of vapors, it's all vapor. It's all a puff of smoke. It's here today, gone tomorrow. What does man gain by all his toil then? Another way of asking the question in verse 3 is, why then are we here if our lives are nothing but vapor? So short and gone so quickly. What are we accomplishing anyway? Why are we here? Verse 4, a generation goes, generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Not literally forever, but forever with regard to a person's lifetime. Life, you know, we're here and then we're gone and then life goes on. And it continues going on with or without us. And to illustrate the cyclical nature of life, he gives three illustrations from nature. The rising and the setting of the sun, verse 5. Like clockwork, you see the sun come up in the west, go down, or come up in the east, go down in the west. Swirling of the wind, and it's kind of like the weather pattern you see on the map. Winds taking the storms in from the Pacific Ocean on through the west coast and across the continent. And you have certain patterns to that. The evaporation cycle. The water doesn't stay where it is, and we know that. We were in the midst of a drought. The water evaporates, and then, Lord willing, it'll come back. We hope and pray. But there are cycles to all of that, and there are cycles to life. All things are full of weariness. Man cannot utter it. Verse 8, the eye is not satisfied with seeing. The ear is not filled with hearing. What has been is what will be done, or what has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. So life is like a giant racetrack. We're going around in continual circles, been there, done that, but are we really getting anywhere? Are we like the hamster in the cage around that little circular thing, just going around and around and around, but not really progressing in the rat race of life? And I give this illustration to non-Christians when I teach this. You get up in the morning, eat breakfast, take a shower, you fight traffic, you go to work, you put in a long day at work, you go home, you put your head on the pillow at night, and you do what the next day? Same thing. And the day after that, and the day after that, and the day after that. And life suddenly becomes monotonous after you've done that enough years. And after you've done certain things enough years, the thrill just won't be quite the same. Disneyland used to be really exciting to me when I was a little kid. And we used to live in Orange County, and we had season passes to take the kids there all the time. And after a while, you know, Disneyland didn't even hold the same thrill. After you've been there, done that a few times. And life is like that. I used to think there were tons of great shows on TV, and now I've got more channels, and I flip the channels and look at every single channel, and you can't find, for some reason, can't find anything interesting to watch anymore. Can you relate to that? The older you get, you can. Is there anything new? Is there anything new under the sun? You know, been there, done that becomes your theme the older you get. It's already been done. It's been done ages before us. Technology changes the equation a little bit, but not the fundamental underlying issues of life. And moreover, verse 11 says, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things, yet to be among those who come after. And after I get done reading that, I ask the question to my non-Christian friend that I'm studying with, or whoever it may be, do you know who your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were? And once in a while, there's a history, or a genealogy buff who will know the answer to that. But 99.9% of us don't know who our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were. Why is that? Why is that anyway? Is the information not available? Ancestry.com, right? It's available. But why is it that we don't know who our forefathers were? Let me have an honest answer. There you go. We don't care. We've got our lives. Now, I want to ask you something. If we're so wrapped up in our own lives that we don't even know the names of our great-great-great-great-grandparents, should life go on? What are the chances that our great-great-great-great-grandchildren will have the foggiest clue about what we're doing right now. And I ask that question. I've asked that question to atheists and agnostics and people who don't have a clue about the Bible, and it's like the first time they've ever thought about that. That we go through the motions of a monotonous life to pass the torch to the next generation, and they pass the torch to the next generation, and they pass the torch to the next generation, and the preceding generations are forgotten. Why were you here anyway? When your life is a puff of smoke, it's a vapor, and no one even knows who you were after you're gone. And it's a good question. It's a question people need to think about in this society. And then when I've got them in the palm of my hand, I go immediately to chapter 2. Chapter 2. And Solomon essentially says, okay, I'm going to break the cycle. My life is going to count. I'm going to be different than everybody else. And so he says in chapter 2, verse 1 beginning, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad and a pleasure. What use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. And you might notice in verses 4 through 8 here, particularly all of the personal and reflexive pronouns, it's me, myself, and I. Okay? I made great works, I built houses, planted vineyards for myself, I made gardens and parks, I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees, I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees, I bought male and female slaves, and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold, the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Thus I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. It's kind of a sad commentary. But you look at what he does here with the drive of a type A personality. He tries to break the endless cycle by embarking on a grand search for happiness. And Solomon has it all. He has fame, power, money, women. Sometimes I allude very quickly to 1 Kings chapter 4, where the text tells us about his horses and his chariots, his building projects, the fact that, you know, he wrote 3,000 Proverbs, 1,005 songs. He built the temple in Jerusalem. Took him about half as long as it took him to build his own great palace. And the temple would have been considered one of the great wonders of the ancient world. And the Queen of Sheba comes in chapter 10, says, I've heard of your wisdom and all your fame and glory, but now I've seen it with my own eyes, heard with my ears, and the half has not been told. In chapter 11, verse 3, we read about 700 concubines, or wives, and 300 concubines, 1,000 women. His reference is selfish. It's me, myself, and I. But, he's trying to beat the system of this never-ending cycle of meaninglessness. And the way that we can relate to that, a good question to ask is the question, fill-in-the-blank question. If I only had blank, then I'd be happy. And what's the number one answer? Money. If I only had $1 million, or right here in California, let's say $10 million, keep it safe. Okay. If I only had $10 million, then my life would be complete, would it? Howard Hughes had a lot of money, and he said he would trade all of it for one happy marriage. Okay, let's take away the money, and let's bring in the wife. If I only had that perfect spouse, then my life would be complete, would it? Not exactly. But I'm married to the most beautiful woman in the world, so
I don't count in that equation.
But no, you understand this, because a lot of people get married and then they're miserable. If I only had children, then I'd be happy. Would you? I got these kids and they're just driving me crazy. And what we need is a bigger vehicle. Put the kids, you know, have the big, you know, SUV and be the soccer mom and all that. Or the bigger house. Put the kids on one side of the house and us on the other. Then I'd be happy. And so you get the bigger house and you get the bigger vehicle. Are you happy? This mortgage payment is killing me. If I only had that advancement in my career, that raise, that big raise, so I could afford to pay all these bills, then I'd be happy. So you start climbing the corporate ladder. Are you happy? Man, this work is killing me. I mean, they're working me 80 hours a week. Oh, to be retired. Then I'd be happy. Are all retired people happy? My body's falling apart. Oh, to be 20 again. I want to tell you something. Solomon had all his blanks filled. He had fame. He had money. He had women. He had pleasure. He had building projects. He had monuments. Archaeologists speak of Solomonic architecture, the Gates of Giza, for example. He had it all, or did he? Thus I considered all that my hands had done, all that I'd undertaken. And it was nothing but vanity striving after wind. And I want to tell you something. I've studied this with a lot of people who don't have the foggiest clue about the Bible, but they get it. And the reason they get it is this is a common human experience. They understand that all these historic pursuits of mankind lead to dead ends. This is not what we're put here for. Then what? What's left? Flash forward to chapter 12, and we're skipping a lot of information, but that's okay. Because in a one-shot lesson, when you got one shot with a non-Christian or a group of non-Christians, it's okay. Chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 12 really work well. I'd like to segue into chapter 12 with the last few verses of chapter 11. Let's look at, for example, verses 7 through 10. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. In other words, while you're still young, go ahead and chase your dreams. Go ahead and get your degree. Go ahead and chase that career. But realize that for everything you pursue, it's fair game for judgment day. Because the Creator is watching over your shoulder, looking at everything you're doing, all your motivations, all your hidden motivations of the heart. And it's all fair game for judgment, which is really a good entry into chapter 12. It's an unfortunate chapter division, really. Chapter 12, verse 1 says, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain. In other words, you remember God now, while you're still young, while you still have your whole life ahead of you. You know, a lot of old people get serious about God toward the very end of their lives, but you start getting serious about God now while you're still young, while you still have energy and your whole life, again, ahead of you. So very important not to wait until the sun, the light, the moon, the stars are darkened. The clouds return after the rain. We have a lot of sunshine here. Wish we had some more rain. Hope we have a good rain this winter. But and Travis would know this well, but we used to live up in Oregon, and in one winter there it rained 33 straight days, and that messes with your mind when you're not seeing the sun day after day, and it's just one cloudy day after another. But figuratively speaking, poetically speaking, there comes a point in your life when it's one cloudy, miserable day right after another, and you think, okay, tomorrow's going to be a better day, and it's not. Well, the day after that's going to be a better day, and it's not. And your sunshiny days become few and far between, and it's one cloudy day, one right after another, and the good days just aren't there any longer. Remember God before that time in your life comes. And in great poetry, he describes the aging process. Verse 3, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble, Parkinson's disease sets in, or the weakness of the limbs, and you begin to shake. The strong men are bent. We have a sister in Christ up in Santa Clara who cannot straighten out her back any longer. You know, it's osteoporosis, and she walks around like this because she can't straighten out her back and be erect like she used to be. So the strong men are bent. The grinders cease because they're few. Your teeth fall out. Those who look through the windows are dimmed. Your eyesight isn't what it used to be. There was a point in my life where I had just perfect eyesight, and I wake up in the morning and things would be blurry, and I'd do this, and instantly I could see as clear as a bell. But it got to a point after a while where I'd do this and it was still blurry, and I'd do this, it was still blurry, and I'd do this, and I said, oh, what have I been missing all these years? And because we lose what we once had, we begin to deteriorate. And the doors on the street are shut, verse 4, when the sign of the grinding mill is low. The grinding mill is the place of hustle and bustle, the place to be. At harvest season, when they bring in the harvest and they separate the wheat from the chaff and grind the grain, and you have all these harvest festivities, anybody who was anybody would be there. But not old people. Through voluntary retirement or forced retirement, they were kind of pushed outside the picture, stay at home. And one rises at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. You can't enjoy all the festivities, can't hear it perhaps, don't enjoy it anymore, so just want to stay home. They are afraid of what is high, verse 5, or high places. Terrors are in the way. Don't want to get out, don't want to take a trip, too much work, don't want to drive at night, just too much work. I just want to stay home. Have you heard that before from an older person? Maybe you said it. The almond tree blossoms, what color? White. The graying of the hair. The grasshopper drags itself along. Grasshoppers aren't supposed to drag. They're full of pep and energy, but at the end of the life cycle of a grasshopper, it just drags. And you see an older person that will leave this auditorium this morning just kind of dragging, and a kid will just run right by him full of pep and energy, and you wish you could bottle that and give it to the older folks, but you can't, because that's just not the way life works. And desire fails. That's literally sexual desire. There comes a point in life where not all the additives in the world, and we live in a society where there's lots of those additives, and I won't get crass in the pulpit, but there still comes a point at which no matter what you do, you can't turn back the clock when you're 80 years old and be 20 again. Because man is going to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets. That's a funeral scene. Before the silver cord is snapped or the golden bowl is broken, the pitcher is shattered by the fountain, or the wheel is broken at the cistern. In other words, an Israelite might have a gold-plated piece of pottery and someone knocks it over and shatters it into 1,000 pieces, and someone said, okay, I'll just glue them right back together, be perfect, right? Wrong. You can't turn back the clock at a certain point. And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. It's all vanity.
And I want to tell you something. If this life is all there is, it is vanity. And whenever I make that point, I don't care what the background of the person is. They get it. Verses 13 and 14. The end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil.
You have childhood in the prime of life fleeting. And the point made that you're going to get old fast. You breathe a few breaths and years go by and you wonder, where did all the years go? I'm not as young as I used to be. And the grave is getting closer and closer. So the compelling conclusion is, this is it. This is the end of the matter. All the investigation is done. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man, for God will bring every deed into judgment with every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. And I taught this for probably hundreds of times before it hit me like a plank on the head to really figure out what was being said here. And I'll tell you, the interesting thing is, the person who helped me understand what Solomon was saying here, more than anyone, was an agnostic. Carl Sagan, famous scientist who years ago wrote the book Cosmos, and they turned it into a PBS series, and now it's a new series. It was on Fox this last year with someone else. But Carl Sagan is the one who came up with that whole idea of the cosmos. The first sentence in Cosmos is, "Cosmos is all that is or was or ever will be." I prefer the first sentence in another book, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." But Carl Sagan also wrote a book toward the end of his life. He called it Pale Blue Dot. And that book was based on the premise of the Voyager 2 spacecraft sent billions and billions of miles into space, and the farther it got away from Earth, as it would take pictures of Earth and send those pictures back to Earth, the Earth got smaller and smaller and smaller until it was finally nothing but a pale blue dot in a vast expanse of space that is so great and so expansive that it staggers our imaginations to even begin to think about how small we are in the bigger scheme of things. We're like ant-like creatures on a pale blue dot in a universe that is gigantic. And Mr. Sagan made this point. He said, "We think that what we're doing here on Earth is so important, but it's really not. All we are is ant-like creatures on a pale blue dot, and there's no one out there who will save us from ourselves." And I want to tell you that when I came across that statement and thought of Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14, the light bulb went on. Because if you take God out of the equation, and you take Judgment Day out of the equation, Mr. Sagan is absolutely right. And so here's the question I ask people as I wrap up this study. Can our lives be invested with purpose and meaning, with eternal dimensions, in the absence of accountability? Does he who die with the most toys really win? We know that that cannot be the case. We have a day in court with God. And we're playing for keeps. And which view of life offers more purpose? A view that eliminates Judgment Day and eliminates God from our program of thought? Or a program of life in which God is there in the center of gravity. And we have to face him one day with everything that we're doing right now. And we're playing for keeps. Life is a probationary period, and everything we do now, everything we think, everything we do, Everything that, every word that comes out of our mouths is fair game for judgment day. Which of those two views gives you more purpose and value? I've asked that question to people who have completely eliminated God from their life program, and they have had no answer to that question because they've never thought about it. And it was in Ecclesiastes about 3,000 years ago. It forces people to think about what people try to put out of sight and out of mind. And that's the lesson for this morning. This is not hard to teach someone else if you just focus on chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 12. Ask a couple of leading questions. And more often than not, by far and away, I've had people who want to come back for more. People who tell me more. Tell me more. And so I use this often on the front end as I dangle my evangelistic carrot with non-Christians. We'll talk about tonight how to build faith in lost souls, how to take them from this point forward to the point where they are knocking on the door of baptism into Christ. That'll be tonight's lesson. But for the moment, we're going to quit. And if there's someone in the group today who needs to come to terms with your God, to fear God and keep His commandments, there's no better time to do that than now. Now is the acceptable time. Now is the day of salvation. You need to repent of your sins, confess your faith in Jesus, be baptized for the remission of every sin you've ever committed. Now's a good time. If we can aid you in that, won't you come as together we stand?